Amazing Odile, welcome to the Future Fashion Business Podcast. Thanks for being
Hi,
here.
Hi, Esteban. Thank you for the invitation.
It's my pleasure. It's actually, you're in California right now. Is it Los Angeles or San Francisco?
Yeah, rainy in Los Angeles today. Like stormy winter and not a good weather.
Interesting. How have you adapted to the Los Angeles lifestyle, as you being from France? I know French people tend to have a difficult time adapting to the Californian culture.
Yeah, I think California is great for people loving who have different people, diverse backgrounds, and being for their energy and not their past. So it's more your future and your potential. I love that.
Amazing. Well, just for the listeners at home that don't really know anything about who you are and what you do, can you just give us a little brief introduction on, you know, who is Odile? What do you do? Just so that people listening at home can have a very clear idea of who they're actually going to be learning from.
Of course. So my name is Odile Rougeol, and I'm French, as you can see my accent, living in California, as I said, and I'm the founder of Fab Ventures, Fab for Fashion and Beauty, and I invest in Seed Stage. And I'm also the founder of Fab Community. We can talk about that later, where startup and founders and investors meet. And I spend a lot of time in my career for working for big companies such as L'Oréal. My latest job working with L'Oréal was to be the CEO of Lancôme, that is now a $3 billion revenues business and in 135 markets and highly profitable. And then I work for telco companies. So my background is, I would say, entrepreneurial spirit, investors, but also understanding well big companies.
Interesting. And if you had to describe who you are now, because I think you've sort of had like the three big experiences, right? Look, the experience as an executive of a brand that is now a multi-billion dollar brand, the experience of an entrepreneur, and also the experience of an investor, right? So you got the big three right there. So what would you define yourself as mostly?
I've got a feeling that when you're 50 plus, which is my generation, you care about your impact. So now what I enjoy the most is guidance and in a way to try to connect the dots with everything that I was grateful to benefit from and to try to give back that to other people that are bold people, because being an entrepreneur, we can talk about that, is pretty, you know, crazy in a way, because it's not very comfortable as a journey.
Yeah, and interesting. And how would you describe for people that are curious on the dynamic of the three disciplines, what are the biggest differences of each one? If you could describe it very succinctly, what is an executive versus an entrepreneur versus an investor? What type of character traits, what type of skill sets define a successful one in either one of those categories?
I would say as an executive, first, you need to manage people. So you need to make sure that you help to grow leaders, you help them to understand the culture of the company and to develop their skills. You're used to the complexity because you've got a lot of counterpowers and, you know, being the CEO of Lancôme, you need to deal with Asia, Latin America, Europe, so different cultures at the same time, the same brand. So you need consistency, but at the same time, adapt to the complexity. And I will say when you're more as an entrepreneur, even if you report to your board because they are guiding you, you're pretty much free to take your decisions. And I will say there are other benefits. I remember when I'd been working as an executive, my calendar was full with meetings and travels. Now I can decide where I go and who I meet and that's pretty much comfortable. So it's less comfortable for ideas and you know, running out of cash every 2 months, like many startups in seed stage. But at the same time, you've got another way of saying I'm free.
Right. My freedom matters. Right. So it's almost like with executive roles, there's a complexity yet predictability. With entrepreneurial roles, there's a freedom, but unpredictability and chaos.
Exactly.
Interesting trade-off. It's a trade-off that I think will teach you a lot about life. You know, we're all trying to balance those two opposites together. Amazing. Well, Adil, we actually do a very quick introduction segment to the episodes, and it's called Fire Questions. And essentially what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you pretty difficult, I guess, general questions. But you're only going to have 10 to 15 answers to answer each one. And it's a great way to get the conversation started and for entrepreneurs to have. It's a little bit more entertaining than the actual technical things that we'll sort of discuss in the rest of the episode. All right. So the first question that I want to ask you out of this fire question segment is, what do you think is overrated business advice?
Overrated business advice? I will say, after the crisis of Silicon Valley, all people were saying growth, growth, growth. And now they say EBITDA, EBITDA, EBITDA. So do your things and be consistent with what you do.
Right. By the way, for people listening, EBITDA is another word for just profit and slow growth. It could just be translated that way. Great. That's a good answer. Okay. And what about underrated entrepreneurial advice?
Talent and team. Yeah. I think if you're self-aware and you've got superpowers, you can't do everything. So if you're self-aware and you care about your team, you're in good shape.
Interesting. And being somebody that's so involved with the technology space of these two industries, what do you think is the next beauty and fashion sort of like consumer business trend?
I would say there are a lot of things about transparency. So I know every people will have said a few months ago, metaverse, blah, blah, blah. I'm not about that, but blockchain and plenty of things about, you know, the sourcing of your materials and ingredients will be, you know, the future of beauty and fashion.
So the ability to communicate with very succinctly and transparently.
Yeah.
Interesting. Biggest lie about business.
It's easy. Piece of cake. No, that's not. It looks like it, but I was talking to the people of Aesop, and a lot of people saying, what, 2.5 billion? The merger acquisition with L'Oreal, that's huge. It's 30 years of work, and they did a great job. So it's tough.
Amazing. What about your luckiest moment in either business or your career?
I would say, I would have said personal with my boys that are now adults, but in business, I think when I was promoted to take the US market, because that was the best gift of my life, because stretching me, and I at that time I was saying, oh, I can't do the job, but that people trusted me and said, you can, help me to be, you know, thinking, oh, maybe I can.
Interesting.
So trust yourself will be my advice. And my best moment is when people trust you and you do things.
Amazing. Well, diving into that question a little bit more, because I've done this episode, I've done these podcasts a lot of times. I've met a lot of, obviously, of entrepreneurs myself, various levels of success. And a lot of times it comes down to somebody else, a pivotal moments in people's careers, whether it be if you're developing as an executive or as an entrepreneur, is somebody else believed in you more than they should have.
Yeah.
More than even. So what do you think is the biggest reason for those catalyst moments to happen? Is it timing? Is it being in the right time? Is it the right place? Is it a specific character trait that sort of attracts people to believe in you, disregarding your ability or your experience? Now as an investor, because you're in a position that can sort of like think about things like that, of believing in people when, you know, everything on paper says that you technically couldn't or shouldn't. What do you think that all comes down to?
I've got the feeling that you read people. Everyone reads people. And it happens to me to say great things to people, even if it's a very bad day or bad month for them. And I think it's like a jewel, because people keep that in them and then convert that into an energy. So I will be more, not about timing, but more about be surrounded by great energies and positive energy. And when you've got that, suddenly you've got a miracle and someone is saying, hey, you.
Yeah. I had a conversation with the CEO of a very, very big beauty company. And we were having this conversation because he kept getting, quote unquote, lucky with the relationships that he was being introduced to or the opportunities that were being presented to him. And I tried to pinpoint what it was. And the thing that he said that made a lot of sense to me is, in order for people to believe in you, the first thing that you need to understand is you need to almost lie to yourself, or not lie to yourself, but be passionate about something about what you do that comes across as something that can overcome your lack of experience. So in other words, if there's something that you're working on that or you're truly passionate about, and you're able to communicate that effectively, eventually there's going to be somebody that's going to believe in you, maybe even more than you believe in yourself at that particular moment in time.
I like it.
But, you know, but being self-aware about what those things are that make you different is what eventually takes somebody else to see that in you, even when you're not self-aware enough to see it yourself yet.
Makes sense.
Amazing. So another quick question. I think this is probably going to be one of the last ones. What is your favorite brand and why?
Favorite brand. I would say in my portfolio at the moment, Kaytin, because I've got the feeling that they fix a big problem. They are empowered by experts, hairstylists, and they do a great product. So I like the brand and I like what they build.
What about brands that are not in your portfolio? They could be bigger institutional brands. They could be.
Yeah, I love Patagonia for plenty of reasons that you know. I think they were very consistent with what they did from the beginning and still now, which is very rare. It's in the long term. So I think it's pretty much also linked to their stakeholders and not just their founder and CEO. So they did a great job.
Interesting. Awesome. Well, diving into the conversation that we're sort of having originally, I do want to ask you about the motivation behind your transition from more of an executive role to, I guess in more traditional words, the transition that you did was before you were focused on your own growth, career development, personal development. And as you said, as you progress through your life, you realize that you want to transition more into a teacher and supportive role. Almost like when you're young, it's all about your career and your own personal development. Then you become a parent, you mature, and it's all about your children. It's a similar transition, I'm guessing.
That's a good way to give the journey. I've got the feeling that when I arrived in the Silicon Valley, in a very, you know, naive way, I was thinking I will find a big job. And finally, I was more taking board seats in different companies, advisory roles, and suddenly a lot of people were pinging me, you know, on LinkedIn saying, hey, we have seen you're the ex-CEO of Lancôme. Could you help us on the deck? So I was not planning to come back to beauty and fashion. And it came back more by the community because as a mentor, I was thinking I can't do that more than 4 hours per month. So I did put together this community with people talking to each other in meetings and networking. And then came the idea, as I was already a business angel, to raise a fund and to find money for especially people, pretty people like you or lifestyle entrepreneur, sustainable as a focus. And if you're in Berkeley, Stanford, Harvard, you will find money and no problem with venture capitalists. If you're doing something that is more about fashion and beauty, you struggle at the beginning, except if you've got a great network of business angels or philanthropists. So I was thinking I can help with my network, and I raised with big, big corporate ventures and family offices that I knew in luxury and retail. So that came more as a community and then investing.
Right. So it's sort of like naturally transitioned because you saw, number one, people organically started asking sort of like for your help. Then you spotted the opportunity that there was no infrastructure that supports that help in the beauty and fashion space specifically as it does in sort of like technology or energy or other different types of industries.
Yeah.
And would you say why did you sort of leave or got away from beauty and fashion in general? Was it just a personal decision? Was it?
At the beginning, it was more because I had a competitive clause, you know, as you were at the top. When I left L'Oreal, I was thinking there are other ways to innovate. And I love it because the culture of L'Oreal is super strong, super consistent, but it's one way of thinking. So I couldn't work for any other beauty corporations. So I came to the telco industry, which is more a service culture because telcos are more like banks, insurance. You've got a subscription model for your mobile or your internet or broadband, and you need to keep the people. So that's funny because it was very different verticals and very different skills because L'Oreal is more MBA people from all over the world. And telco industry or tech, as you know, it's more master in computer science, engineers. So I like the contrast of working with different people.
Contrast of working with highly technical and creative people versus highly people that are, what would you say managers and are, because it's kind of like what I've realized out of almost every industry, and this applies specifically to fashion and beauty as well, it's just as it applies in tech, is that there's two big sort of like skill sets. One is technical and creative in the technology space, that usually represent as engineers. In the fashion design world, that's usually represented as creative director or product oriented people. And then there's the visionary, the salesperson, you know, in tech, the Steve Jobs, in fashion. I wouldn't really know how to put it in fashion, a specific example, but would you say that it's a very, very similar dynamic in terms of what succeeds or what makes a great team and, you know, a solid foundational beauty or fashion business? Is it usually technical and creatively driven people? Is it a mixture of creatively driven, technically talented, and visionary and really good at persuasion and communicating the vision? What would you say is or are the most common traits of really, really high level entrepreneurs in this space specifically?
I've got a feeling that when you're about tech and especially telcos, you've got a lot of capex and investments. So you're very good in data, facts, and risk assessment. So for me, it was slow when I arrived in the new industry and vertical compared to L'Oreal, where beauty with visionaries and collections, and it's fast, you know, and decision-making is quick and you execute very quickly, in fact. So I've got the feeling that both worlds have a different way to look at things. But if you take the best of the different skills, and especially entrepreneurs now, you need both skills to understand, you know, the risk assessment and to collect data and knowledge about your customers. And at the same time, to be fast to execute and very good at the way you execute things.
Interesting. So that being said, how would you describe your personal decision-making process? Is it, how much of it is qualitative? How much is it of it is quantitative? How much do you look at the brand and design and the vision?
I would say it's very quantitative, but at the same time, I'm very intuitive. So when I meet founders, I know that a lot of people will say, I have a due diligence of 7 days for a startup. I can say after half an hour of a conversation in Zoom, if I will invest or not, in fact. So I'm pretty fast to, but then I do the rational. I try to collect information, to check with different people. But most of the time, my decision-making is done in 30 minutes.
Interesting. And have you able, because I'm guessing you're a very self-aware person, have you able to pinpoint what is your decision-making? What is your intuitive decision-making checklist? Are you looking for passion? Are you looking for trustworthiness? Are you looking for work ethic? Are you looking for...
Great. You know? Check. There's three of them. I would say people that fix big problems. So I'm not about the big markets, etc., where people say, oh, it's a huge market. But they fix something that didn't exist before as a solution. And second, I can guess their self-aware, that means they're collaborative. Because most of the time, as an investor, I'm not taking the lead, so I don't have a board seat. I need them to be very collaborative and to add me as a trusted member of the team. If they don't ask advice on demand, then I disappear and I don't have any impact on what they're building. So most of the time, it's visionaries, but at the same time, very collaborative in the way they interact with people.
Interesting. Yeah. So almost very assertive visionaries with enough humility to understand that they're going to need other people in order to get to where they want to get
to. Absolutely. So it's very much about the people.
Interesting. Yeah. And I think people don't understand that it really all comes down to that self-awareness. I think people don't speak about self-awareness enough. My motto, funny enough, is self-discovery through art and business. And it's just because of that reason. Once you understand that if you know who you are, you can manipulate almost every single variable outside of yourself to get to where you want to get to. Whether those variables are people, whether those variables are money and leverage or investment, whether those variables are customers, it really all comes down to understanding, what am I? What am I good at? What am I bad at? What do I enjoy doing? What do I need? You know, what is this problem?
And as an investor, people forget, but it's like a couple. You're here for a long time because it's 7 to 10 years.
Yeah.
So if you don't like the interaction with your investor, don't take him or don't take her. And the reverse, if you think the founder each time is very defensive, you don't enjoy the interaction.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. It's also an analogy that I've used a lot in this episode as well. And whenever you're trying to approach partnerships, it's the same as dating, right? Is do you trust this person? Do you have compatible values, or do you want to rip each other's yes. heads off every day? Mm-hmm. Or you know, can you have difficult conversations and communicate and move forward? It's a very very similar it's a very similar process, whether it is business partners and investors in this case.
Yeah,
interesting. And what questions? Because you said that you don't necessarily look for big markets, which is usually a no-no for investors. You know, investors is one of the most, usually the most common things that they look for. Why in your case, why you're not particularly interested in, or you don't really care about, or it's not that you don't care about them, but why is it not?
I think founders are very good at putting big figures, but mm-hmm. what is the most important is if you're the best at something, let's say for instance, Bubble, I was speaking about Kaitin about hair color. Mm-hmm. And you're the best in hair care for hair color. Mm-hmm. Or if you're Bubble, teen skincare. Teen skincare, we could say, oh yeah, but Gen Z are not very loyal. And mm-hmm. it's not a huge average order because it's affordable. So each time you could have weaknesses. But if you're the best at doing that, for instance, Bubble Shy Eisenman, she began as a D2C company, had a lot of influencers, word of mouth. She was on many platforms for Gen Z. And now she's at Walmart. CVS, Ulta Beauty, and she's scaling and she's having great figures. Everything in 3 years, you know, mm-hmm. but she's very good at something. You need mm-hmm. to be thinking, I'm the best at the state of the art of whatever, curly hair or live streaming or whatever.
Interesting. Yeah. So it's almost like if you reverse the question, instead of starting, what's the biggest market that I can address is, Where is the strongest impact that I can have? If you solve that question properly, you can either end up in big markets or create large marketplaces yourself.
Absolutely. So and maybe also the fact that I'm a solo GP and a seed stage fund, mm-hmm. I'm always thinking of the merger acquisition as an exit. I'm not dealing with unicorns. I think I don't have the shoulders to be the one part of a huge round of 20 million. I think at the moment, a lot of people are coming back to that. That means having a company with a community, knowledge about customers, and mm-hmm. a positive EBITDA. So again, profitable one day.
Yeah, they're making money.
To, trying to do the 1 billion business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Interesting. So what are those fundamental principles that you look for in a business that has the right foundations to take on investment? Is it a strong community with good products, as you said, profitability? Are those the three variables that you look for?
Absolutely. I would say I check very much the products themselves, because mm-hmm. if it's products or services, it needs to work. So whether it's a SaaS solution, and then I check with other venture capitalists that are very good in tech, that the product management is perfect, or just if they develop something for the skin, let's say Wina, for instance, it's a traditional Chinese medicine platform with very premium products. Mm-hmm. I just make sure that each time they've got the test and things, because if you don't have a good retention rate and you can't keep your customers, then you have to acquire them. And as you know, the cost of acquisition at the moment are huge. So if you don't create the word of mouth by the own customers of your brand that are talking about you, then you're in trouble. So first products, and of course, we come back to the fundamentals you described, the founders themselves and the brand, the uniqueness.
Interesting. And what creates that, what's the word that they use in tech for that, you know, customers coming back, churn? What creates churn in fashion and beauty focused businesses or brands? Because the value proposition is very different, right? When you're looking at technology, it's very rational tech usually, right? If I use this product, I save time, or I save money, or I get this particular tangible benefit. When you're working with fashion and beauty, it's a physical product that usually has very, very, the competitive advantage could just be that the community is closer, right? That it just, the message resonates. So
I would say if you want to avoid people to churn, so that means to leave your company and brand, you need to have an emotional connection. I've got the feeling that now people want to belong. And it comes back to exactly what you say. When you've got friends, Most of the time you share some interests or values or, you know, things that are your passion. And brands now or companies, they've got that. Even if you're a SaaS solution, for instance, I invested in Bluebird Climate. You could say Bluebird Climate is about decarbonization and trying one day to have a solution that is a commodity compared to the, all the costly certification like big corporations that ask for brands a lot of energy and money. But it's also that they're in the conversation with other brands and founders and their people. So it's not just a SaaS solution with data and metrics that save your money, save your time. It's also that you connect to them as human beings.
Interesting. And with your experience and the career that you've had so far, when you look at the general landscape right now for fashion and beauty businesses or fashion or beauty brands, are you an optimist? Are you a pessimist? Or you're dabbling in between both of them?
I'm an optimist, but there are a lot of things to fix. I will say on beauty, as you know, the FDA is not looking at all the little brands. So it's pretty messy. I'm investing now also in longevity, you know, supplements, but longevity like NAD. It's the far west, you know. If you're not a good person and you don't do ugly things, you're okay. I think it needs to be better than that. We need to prove that things work and the same for fashion. Fashion was very much about, and especially fast fashion with retailers, about, you know, having new collections, new clothes. The awareness of Gen Z and millennials is great, but most of the time they don't have a lot of money. They continue to purchase very bad things with a lot of polyester and nylon, and contributing to impacting in a bad way the planet. And it's not very healthy for all of us. So I think I'm positive, but even big corporations that have, you know, the ability to improve, I think they're aware. Some of them are still, you know, more in the communication and trying to make good stories. It's more than that. We need really to think of how long we keep our clothes, the second life of our clothes after in vintage, you know, and second hand stores, and the same for beauty, recycling, thinking of packaging, less consuming when you deliver. Plenty of things that we need to improve as customers and as brands.
Of course, yeah, it's difficult, right? Because I mean, businesses are usually responding to the customer's incentives. We're as business owners, as entrepreneurs, everybody has a boss, right? As a business owner, as an entrepreneur, you're enslaved to your customer, what they're attracted to. And unfortunately, people, although they have a conscious need to improve, human nature does not let that happen very easily. You know, if you give young people, if you get young people two options, sure, on one end, they want to make the world a better place, of course. But on the other hand, they can't afford it and they can't wear clothes that are going to make them look good to their, in front of their friends. Then they're just going to buy the fast fashion, right? They're going to compromise on their values based on what's easier for the human psyche to make that decision based on. But in fashion and beauty specifically, I see two big challenges. Of course, there's a challenge from a consumer perspective, as you were saying, but also if you're trying to solve those issues or work on those issues, you need capital. Right. And capital in these industries is not as easily accessible as in something like technology, you know, for example. So what do you think this really all comes down to? Is that how does this problem even begin to start solving itself over long periods of time? Is it education?
I've got the feeling, you know, you've got it when you give the facts, is that first it's the customers. For instance, I invested in Brightly. It's a platform for Gen Z, mostly TikTok, Instagram, where they've got stories about what you can improve. If you open your fridge, if you, you know, purchase at your grocery store, or if you're in your home or having your beauty habit. So you can't be perfect on everything. So for instance, when I arrived from Paris, I was selling all my clothes and wardrobe. And I was feeling so bad because I was thinking, why did I need all of that? You know, so I did the job in a way to try to continue to have it for other people and customers and to extend the life of the clauses. But some of my friends travel a lot. So you could say, hey, you're impacting the world. So I think on a customer point of view, it's not judging people. It's just to say, hey, let's try to be aware and improve on different things every day and be better.
Yeah.
On the brand point of view, as you're fully aware, the corporations are pretty wealthy and highly profitable. So I've got the feeling we come back to the regulation. Pushed by the customers, governments and people should vote laws that makes more pressure on profits, because else the boards are the boards and the stakeholders are the stakeholders, and will continue to ask for highly profitable companies. So there is a need of pressuring big corporations.
Yep.
And then if you take the startups, I think in their DNA, as they're funded by millennials or Gen Z people, they're pretty much connected to what we say. And again, you can't be perfect at the beginning. So you need to choose your battle where you're very good at, exactly like you're very good as a brand, you fix a big problem, you're very good in sustainability on something or circularity, and then step by step, you improve in the future because you've got more money and more funds and more.
Interesting. So the first line of defense, to put it this way, to solving a problem like this is, because it's an industry that has so much momentum going to a specific direction, it needs something very strict, such as political regulation, and it needs companies with access to a lot of resources to be forced to take those incentives to start moving the pendulum the other way. Now, that doesn't mean they're the one they're going to push the pendulum to the other way, because that's up to the startups and the people that are joining and the young people that are innovating on technologies and on the forefront of this movement. But they are needed in order to slowly start slowing down the pendulum and the massive wage of momentum that these industries have had in that direction for, decades.
Yeah. The only thing, if we are rational, is that normally you should say to people, consume less. And I don't think any company will say that.
Right.
So it needs to be consumed smarter. I think, for instance, in the US, I'm shocked by the number of returns we've got. It's super costly for the planet because, shipping back and things like that. So I believe that in a way we can be with better choices, and maybe less things, but keeping them, a longer time.
Interesting. Yeah, which comes down to better choices usually comes down to the innovators, the small companies, the entrepreneurs. And how's the overall supportive environment for those entrepreneurs? Because that's something that you're very close and related to. How is that infrastructure? Does it exist? Is there capital? Is it easily available? Especially during times like this, because consumer businesses, fashion, beauty, they're very vulnerable in recessions, or in periods of more than recessions, of periods of economical uncertainty. So how confident do you feel on the support and the infrastructure that's being provided to the entrepreneurs that will create the products, the brands of the future?
I'm confident for all of them. I think in the short term, it's tough, but for 2023, let's be honest, we were talking about the banks and the crisis and the loans that are, limited now. So in fact, especially the ones that have signed with big retailers, it's very costly in inventories.
Yeah.
And I don't think some of the founders realize what they were signing for, because now they need to ship their products and they need to pay for the inventories for, shipping the products. But if you look at the midterm, I will say, if you're good with your customers, you've got your community, you've got great products, they come back, one way or another, you will be profitable. And then if you're profitable and you fix a problem and you know very well your customers, then you will be good. I see also good signs with impact investors. There were a lot of funds, for instance, Kintra Fibers in my portfolio, they're inventing a new material that is replacing the polyester and nylon, and that is maybe less costly than tencel, that is super expensive. Their cap table is interesting. That means their investors are H&M, the fast fashion retailer, that tries to do better, which is a good sign for all of us. And their role model on that. They are also impact investors, meaning that they invest in Kintra that is still super small in revenues, because they believe that we need this kind of material in the future. So there are different people, tech investors, consumer brands investors, impact investor, and all these people go in the same direction, trying to help innovation and change makers in their industry.
Interesting. So what would you say is the responsibility that every founder and entrepreneur needs to feel responsible for? What's the one thing that they need to, because it's a very complex landscape, right? With a lot of things going on, investors, this, the crisis, this, my customers here is building a team here, making any sale whatsoever here. What are they truly responsible nowadays? Are they, should they be focusing on how can my product make the world better? Should they be focusing on?
I think it's very simple. If you've got 100 customers at the beginning, they must be happy and say to you, I'm happy in the reviews, in the net promoter scores, in the feedback. And if 100 are happy, normally they should convince other people, then you've got 1,000 and then you grow, you know? So I would say the customer experience and satisfaction was always the core of every company in the world. And now more than ever, especially with the social media where you need to be authentic, you can have bad reviews very quickly. You know, I'm thinking of Olaplex that I was sued for one of their products and then had, you know, a lot of difficulties in their sales. Everything is super transparent. So customer satisfaction and the fact that you're authentic is the responsibility of founders.
Interesting. So
I try to avoid anyone that is storyteller in a bad way. I mean,
marketers
stories, but you know, not checking. It happened to me, for instance, to have people claiming to be clean beauty. And when I was doing the due diligence, there were some ingredients that were not even available at Sephora or Credo Beauty or the Detox Market Beauty. That's not okay. And if people are defensive, then I just stop the conversation. So that happens.
Yeah, it's the dilemma of great marketing versus great product, right? You need both. And if you could pick one, ideally you need to pick product. I think a way to summarize it would be businesses need to focus on their product and the relationship that their product has with their customer. And they need to be patient. And they need to be patient. Patient is a very important word. Because I think what happened, especially last couple of years, is because people are naturally impatient, founders, customers, and investors. There was a lot of capital available that fueled their impatience. Faster growth, no profit, doesn't matter. Let's just grow, sell it in 5-6 years, and then, you know, play the hot potato game, right? Somebody will catch you on the other side, whether it be different investors or shareholders, and that's it. But nowadays, people are starting to realize the mistake of that philosophy. So it comes down to the foundational principles, which is, again, a good product and a good community and patience, long-term vision, not something short-term will eventually sort of like help you through difficult and good times.
It was of wisdom.
I get the opportunity to repeat a lot of things that other people say, you know, because I do have a lot of conversations and it seems like I take credit for it.
It's wealth of wisdom.
Interesting. Well, thank you. Let's see. Okay. And what are your biggest, I guess, now we covered a little bit more about the things that are challenges about this industries, but what other things are you excited for?
You talk a lot about tech and I agree with you. So at the moment, I have all my friends talking about ChatGPT and trying in the tech part, you know, to invent the ecosystem around that. I would say for beauty, for instance, computer vision is huge. I invested in Loom Lash, you know, that is putting lash extensions. I invested in SaaS solutions like Look, that is booking models and paying them very quickly with a flawless solution. So I've got the feeling that tech enables things that were not possible before, and we should enjoy.
Yeah, and what I've noticed is that it also gives beauty and fashion brands an additional layer of competitive advantage. Because when you're starting, the biggest question that you're always or should be asking yourself is, what am I doing that's different? And 10, 20 years ago, what you were doing different was very limited, right? Because the things that would make you different may be your brand, the way you marketed yourself, who you were associated with. But nowadays, with how fast and easily accessible technology is, there could be anything that could make your brand unique from a technological perspective, a new process from a sustainability perspective, a new marketing strategy, right? You're the beauty brand that uses ChatGPT and that makes you creatively unique. That's optimized for AI learning or whatever. It just gives the everyday entrepreneur more opportunities and more access to what's going to make their brands unique. And you don't need to be, mm-hmm. I don't think you need to be a technology expert. You need to at least be just curious about what's going on.
I also believe that education is super important. For instance, I invested in STIX. They're about, you know, reproductive rights and everything that is about, you know, embarrassing problems for a woman. Yeah. So they've got a great library, etc. But I've got a feeling that there are solutions now to shop that are very exciting, like buy with live streaming, where you've got someone explaining to you what you purchase, in fact, or Trendyol, it's the same, it's ex-Amazon guys, so very much tech people. They began by beauty, but you can have someone educating you how to use the product and things like that. So I've got a feeling that tech will help us in mm-hmm. the future, because we are in a more holistic approach of, for instance, beauty, wellness, close to women's health or health tech. We have learned a lot during the COVID with, you know, all the doctors available online and trying to help you to diagnose what you've got and not meeting you, which is, you know, improving what was available before in a new way.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. And I want to think about how to ask this question properly, taking advantage that you are French. So you're going to have a very good, very, very, very reliable perspective on this. When you're trying to balance this act of, okay, if you're starting a fashion or beauty brand, it used to be closer related to branding. That's why it's called a beauty and fashion brand, not a fashion and fashion business. But nowadays, because technology is taking over and it just permeates every single industry in so many different ways, it's kind of difficult to stay loyal to what creates great brands, which is, you know, heritage and tradition. Somebody with your background, both as a French person and also worked in the brands that you've worked in, where do you see this? Is it a delicate balance going on? Is there still space for creating heritage and tradition-based brands that are fueled by creativity and technological innovation? Is it one or the other? Is it both? Where should founders try to position themselves in what they're building? How far into the past as something, a brand that can last the ages or the decades, but also how far into the future?
I believe, as you're aware, Hermès, Chanel are in very, very good health at the moment. So future belongs to great brands with a territory and an heritage. But if you're a new founder coming, you come back to high quality and being consistent in what you do. So from time to time, it can be very affordable and very much, you know, trendy, edgy. From time to time, it can be super premium with an experience that you could have more as a VIP in a very premium context. If you're consistent with what you do, you've got all the ingredients to build a brand in a way or another. Mm-hmm. So I've got the feeling that the only thing I advise people is to be inclusive. So when I say that, I give on purpose an example of brand Girl Gem, founded by Malaika Jones and Ty Beauchamp. They are Black founders. But when I met them, what I love is the first thing they said to me, "We're inclusive." And I said, "What do you mean by that?" And I was saying, "We've got Caucasian people, Asian and Hispanic as customers, and 50% of our customers are Black." And the fact that they were thinking like that, already thinking about being in the Middle East or in Latin America, I was thinking that it was great, because they are using their territory and their roots and their culture, but at the same time, just caring about, you know, having nice sense and a wellness approach. It stands for, you know, uplifting your mood and at the same time, welcoming all people. So being inclusive is part, I would say, of what could matter, even more than heritage or being contemporary and being consistent in what you do. The worst is to be in the middle. You don't know if you're premium or if you're, you know, targeting an affordable positioning.
Yeah. And what difference, because I mean, ideally, fundamental laws of businesses, a good business charges as much money as it can at as little money as it can produce, right? So when you analyze heritage-based brands, premium-based brands, and you look at the margins, which is, you know, the indicator of a brand that's working or not, but then on the other side, you see how difficult it is to get to that position. How do you balance that as a startup entrepreneur? How do you know where to truly position yourself? How do you even begin to start making those decisions? Because I think everybody wants to start a Hermes, right? Everybody wants to start a premium brand because of the value that's associated with that level of branding. But reality is that you can't really, doing that from zero is not very...
I don't know. I think in a way I mentioned Sticks on UTI when their insight was to say, I don't want to meet the mother of my boyfriend in the CVS because I want to have a pregnancy test. They okay. are very much about, you know, affordable for all people, and you can be super upscale in another way, like Wina, where mm-hmm. you've got a premium, a décolleté cream, and maybe you will be in a very upscale hotel. Again, if you're consistent with what you do, everything is okay.
Interesting. And what do you think that consistency needs to come from? Does it need to come from your vision? Does it need to come from yourself? Does it need to come from your customers?
Again, it comes back to your purpose. When I choose people, it's purpose-driven and data-driven. If you want to fix something and it matters to you because you wake up every morning thinking, okay, for the 10 years to come, I'm obsessed by that. It needs to be important for you. Mm-hmm. So it comes back exactly like you're doing this podcast. I'm pretty sure if I ask you, it's not for money. It's for making sure that your audience is happy and you've got the feeling that you help people to grow as a person and as a leader. If you ask me as an investor, it's the same. So you come back to who you are and why you do things.
Mm. Okay. And who are you and why do you do these things? What are your answers to those questions?
You mean for me or for the founders?
For yourself, yes, for yourself.
For me, it comes back to the fact that I'm sure you're aware, only 2% of the fundings go to female founders and underrepresented founders. Mm. 2%. I think if you look at the number of companies that are built by female founders, for instance, it's more than 12%, and already it's not enough. So for me, it was to fix that. Mm-hmm. Thinking, it's like AI. I got a son in computer vision. If you've got the machine that are trained by only guys, I love you guys, but maybe you need also the diversity and to have female leaders training mm-hmm. the machines, because else there will be cognitive biases, because we mm-hmm. are all human and we do all yeah. this. So what I wanted to fix is that with my small, I will say, power of influence, but trying to be one of the investors that are helping to have more underrepresented founders, gay people, Hispanic, Korean, Chinese Americans, first generation or second generation of immigrants. For me, it's super important that we've got that.
Interesting.
Diversity empowers innovation.
So if you're diverse, if you're a minority, if you're female, if you have a good product, if you have a good community, yeah. make sure to contact me.
With a great idea and being collaborative.
amazing. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. And more of a personal question, but when you describe your decision-making style, would you say you're more rational? Would you say you're more intuitive and passionate? Where does your decision
you know,
come from?
I invest money that is not my own money, because mm-hmm. I've got investors and LPs. Course. So I owe them to be very rational. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm very much about the trust relationship that I build for the long term with the founders, that I enjoy to interact with them. But I'm very much about the data about what they have built, their business plan, how they think about the future, that they're aware of the ecosystem, mm-hmm. That they're collaborative. And again, I don't think direct-to-consumer brands are in a good shape now if they're just pure models. So they need to be open, to be omnicanal, but to be aware that retailers will take a part of the margin. So it needs to be people that understand the ecosystem, in fact.
Interesting. And now, this is a completely unrelated question, but I'm really interested to get your perspective on that. Because, you know, a couple of years ago was all about having, you know, having one point of sales channel, you know, the whole D2C movement that started because you didn't need to sell to retailers. You could just sell directly through a customer and the website. What do you think changed that? Is it, where does that need come from? Is it that people are just not used to buying things from places they don't know or enjoy or have a connection with?
I still think direct to consumer is super important, because if you ask me as a Lancome CEO, I was blind. That means I had millions of customers, but I needed surveys to understand what was going on, because the retailers don't share with you the data and the knowledge of the customers. So for me, the value, if you come back to the exit of startup founders in consumer brands, will be especially their community and the data they collect about their customers. They need the retail to grow the awareness and to increase their revenues in a period where the fundings are more difficult because of the high interest rate and the fact that they need one day or another to be profitable. But in a way or another, the main value of their company will be what they know about their customers. We come back to the knowledge of the customers and the data.
Interesting. And when you say data, if you could summarize it, because I think that...
Insights. That means...
Of course.
Your life, for instance, that you consume this product, but at the same time, you do that and that, and you live in a city that is like that. So not the socio-demographics, because we had that in the past, but more the way you live.
Okay, interesting. And what do you think, if you could summarize data, because data is a word that can be very overwhelming for startup entrepreneurs, right? Because data could be anything. Data has almost infinite levels of complexity when you're looking at analyzing data. So what should be the data that founders, entrepreneurs should be focusing on improving in their own brands or in their own businesses? Is it as simple as make as much money as I can and keep as much money as I can while doing something that is worth it? Is that a good way to summarize data points they should be focusing on?
I will say, in the past, I've learned that with L'Oreal, you need to learn from what they don't like about your products. You know, the dislikes, the complaints. I remember a few years ago, people wanted to invest in Glossier, and I was saying, it's too late. Or you are investing at the beginning when the valuation was reasonable, but now the valuation is too high. And whatever they say, the community doesn't receive a lot of feedback when they complain about a clumpy mascara or a foundation not blending very well, which is not a good sign as a culture. So when I say insight, it's insight about the customer, but also insight about the products, because you need to fix things and to improve. And I could say the same about the SaaS solution, because it needs to be flawless in order to save time and money for the clients.
Learning
from the bats.
Awesome. Yeah, so data that solidifies the biggest point that we're talking about. Data that's going to help you understand if your product is good and if your relationship with your product and the customer is there.
Yeah, and improving, because every year
Interesting. And when you said, and just to sort of like wrap this episode up before we wrap everything up, when you say, when it comes to evaluating businesses intuitively, is it an intuitive sense of when a business is overvalued? Is it you analyze the share price per, you know, how do you know a business is overvalued?
Alors, first, I invest in seed stage. Glossier that I mentioned was in late stage, as you know. So when I invest in seed stage, I would say valuations are in consumer brands between $7 to $10 million, you know, pre-revenues. When I see people saying to me, oh, I'm pre-revenue and I want $13 million or even $20 million, I pass. Whatever. It can be brilliant. She can be brilliant. And I just say, hey, you know what? Good luck to you, because
good
it's
for
not
you.
Now the problem is the next round, because you put yourself with a lot of pressure of having the best KPIs and performance for the coming years. And especially the evaluation when you're in seed is not that important, you know. So that means you don't understand that if you're saying that. So I try to have something that is in the standard of the market. But for instance, if you ask me at the moment, in biotech, the evaluations are far above what is in consumer brands and can be at $20 million, even with small revenues per year, like $1 million. So depending on where you were, or SaaS, as you know, the evaluations are far higher, even for $3 million. revenues. So depending on the category, and I learned a lot also discussing with a lot of different investors, because they perceive me more as an ally than a competitor, because as I'm not taking the lead on the term sheet, most of the time I add a lot of value to the people, and at the same time, I'm helpful for the other investors. So for instance, Trendyo was recommended to me by Madrona Ventures, that is the biggest fund in Seattle, very connected to the Microsoft and Amazon ecosystem. Then I met the founders, Alex Perez from Trendyo, and he was beginning by beauty. So I help on the beauty understanding, and they're very good at what they do on tech as an investor. So you need different superpowers around the founder to be successful.
Interesting. So just to wrap this episode up, so you don't have to rush to whatever meeting you have going next, if you could give a single piece of advice to the entrepreneurs listening in the home, other than focus on, you know, the product and the relationship with your product and your community, what would it be? What do you think is...
Surround yourself very well at home, because it's a nightmare for many years, because I see a lot of people that were nearly having their company dying, you know, 6 times in the last 3 years. So if you don't have at home a partner in life accepting that, or even your family understanding that, that's tough. And then the same, you need to have good energies around you, because as a founder, you're pretty much lonely, because the employees you've got depend on you. So you need to be each time with a great energy, and you will have from time to time bad days or decision to take to lay off people, etc. So you need a circle of trust. So most of the time, people understand VCs as the best for their board. You need to have advisors that one day could be independent members that could help you to be one day at 11 p.m. if you call them. They could help you on something. So surround yourself with positive energy at home and at work.
Interesting. Yeah. So it's, again, build the environment that's going to be, that's going to help you succeed. That's going to prove the probability
shine
of succeeding.
And thrive. Yeah.
Amazing. And build that environment through people, mostly.
Yes.
People and good people, good products, and a good community.
Yeah.
Of customers.
People first.
Interesting. Amazing. Amazing. Well, thank you very much for sharing all that information. I think it's very valuable to get the perception and the point of view of an investor.
It was a pleasure to have this conversation. And thank you again for the invitation and for what you do with the podcast. Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And hopefully we can have a second conversation
now
soon.
Of the community.
Yes. Welcome. Welcome to the Future of Passion Business community. But again, thank you, Adil. And I hope we can have this conversation again sometime in the future.
With great pleasure. Have a good day. Take care. Bye-bye.